Chapter 36 Continued. My cell rang on the way home, not 10 minutes after leaving Blair in the parking lot, looking like he'd been worked over for his last bit of pocket change. It was Simon Hunter, shouting above the air rushing through his convertible wind tunnel. I could tell that this was not Simon's normal weekly call, in which he made some pretense of checking on the status of Price Point, inquired after my healing ribcage, and, more recently, discussed my precarious and public relationship with Zach West. On that score, Simon was torn between affording Zach every benefit of the doubt as the linchpin of the Price Point project, which was still the biggest feather in Simon's cap when it came to managing my career, and wanting to be my noble protector against knaves. Knowing that any inkling of an interest in Simon would have sent him off in search of dueling pistols, I always steered clear of any suggestion that Zach's loss might be Simon's gain. This time, Simon's accented voice bubbled and popped with the fresh energy that came with a bona fide reason to actually meet up in person. I didn't have the heart to tell him that I knew why he was calling. Tills! Simon. Damn good news. I've got it and you'll want it. Where are you? Let's pop into the Ivy and have something fizzy with a lime.
Can't, Simon. Sorry. I'm almost home. What's the news?
Right. Email from Milton just an hour ago. He said the Lion Tree project is a go. Blair Gaines dropped off a script. He wants to take a lunch meeting.
Blair?
No, silly. Milton, are you free?
I was thinking Renee's at the plaza. Simon, have you actually spoken to Milton?
About lunch?
About the Lion Tree.
Oh, no. Been a bit ragged lately, Tills. Haven't really been in the office for the whole week, making deals. It's been a banner week, and this is the topper. So?
Renee's, 11:30. I hung up, knowing that Simon's enthusiasm would meet a bucket of cold water by 11:31. And that whatever chance Blair Gaines had of convincing me to trust him, he had absolutely no chance of working that same magic on Milton Chenoweth. As it turned out, I was wrong in my prediction about the bucket of cold water, but only by about 3 minutes. When Simon Hunter and Milton Chenoweth stepped off the elevator into the lobby of Renee's Bistro, Simon's face told the story of a slow and surprising elevator ride. Simon offered a hug without his usual effusive charm. Milton bowed slightly and took my hand, kissing it. The tremor in his own hand reverberated up to my shoulder.
Tilly Johns, as I live and breathe,
said Milton, straightening again to his full height. His silver-white mane stood in stark contrast to his dark blue suit.
You're looking fresh and lovely as ever.
I curtsied to acknowledge the quaintness of the greeting and looked over at Simon. He smiled perfunctorily and then turned his whole attention to the hostess, ensuring we had a table with a view of the city as he had requested. Lunch itself was purely social, with Milton holding court and parading his apocryphal yarns about the old greats of Tinseltown. The Duke meets a dandy. Marilyn Monroe goes canoeing in a duck pond with Dean Martin and a thermos full of gin. Mae West's cleavage eats Bing Crosby's olive.
No one laughed harder than Milton, which somehow made the stories all the more enjoyable. Simon laughed on cue, but stayed attentive to his plate and his cell phone, which buzzed like a bee trapped under a glass. When the plates had been cleared, Milton ordered his third glass of Chardonnay and cleared his throat. Suddenly, as if by magic, a totally different person.
"Tilly,"
he said severely,
"we need to talk some business."
"Yes," I said. "Simon told me." Milton held up a large, shaking paw.
"I understand Simon had a conversation with you yesterday. We'll get to that in a moment. But we need to have an understanding before we head down that road. When I am disappointed in a client, I don't like to let it fester and get bigger than it needs to be. My style is to come right out with it, deal with it head on. Understand?"
I glanced at Simon, who was fascinated with his empty water glass. I nodded.
"Good,"
he said, as if we had just cleared a significant hurdle.
"We have a contract, Tilly, you and me. Or rather, you and CTR have a contract. And that contract is an exclusive contract. That contract, for which we have paid a lot of very expensive lawyers to sweat every jot and tittle, says that CTR is your exclusive agent. Our part of the arrangement is to work hard for you, to find work commensurate with your inestimable talent, and to help manage the business end of your career. It's a jungle out there, doll. You know it, and I know it. And you need someone in your corner who can spot the sharks and keep you moving forward. Forward and up, Tilly. Forward and up."
The wine came, and he took a slow sip.
"And I hope that you will agree that we have so far lived up to our end of that bargain. Price Point was a hell of a get. I mean, right out of the box, we plugged you into the Lion Tree, which went south for no fault of either you or us. And then, whammo, here comes Price Point, and where others stumbled, you kept moving forward and up. And you can thank Simon here for that save, not me. I just made a call or two."
Simon looked like he wanted to crawl under the table.
"Now, CTR has not built its name by resting on its laurels. We have a continuing obligation, and we have to keep working if we want to keep your business. But a contract has two sides, Tilly. You have obligations too. And one of those obligations is to direct all communications regarding potential work opportunities through us. Through CTR. That's what it means to have an exclusive agency agreement. Now, you're a bright kid, and I know you already know all of this. So, imagine my disappointment when Mr. Gaines paid me a visit and informed me that you had re-auditioned for the Lion Tree."
"But, Milton," the quavering paw shot back above the table.
"What disturbs me, Tilly, is not that you auditioned or that you chose to disregard my advice as to the worthiness of that particular job."
"Milton, you found me the job to begin with."
"Even so. When a deal turns rotten, you pay me to give you my professional opinion. And you will recall that my professional opinion, bluntly stated, was that Mr. Gaines was conducting himself like an unscrupulous amateur, not worthy of your valuable time and talent, and further, that I had never seen anything like his little independent movie fiasco in all my years. Now, that was my opinion. There is nothing in our contract that says you have to share my opinions. You are free to ignore them at your peril. So again, what disturbed me was not that you chose to re-audition in spite of my opinion. What disturbed me was that you told me point blank that you were not interested in auditioning when you had already done so. What disturbs me is that you lied to me.
Milton drank his wine and wiped the rim of his glass with his napkin, letting each of his words land on the table like dark, accusing birds. Blood gushed into my cheeks. In that instant, I saw not Milton Chenoweth, but my own father, sitting at the end of our dinner table, rubbing the rim of his wine glass like a talisman. I am omniscient in this memory. I see him from above, from the vantage point of the staircase, ascending above the dining room in the days before the big remodel. I am in my nightie, gripping the white wooden newel posts, listening to my father lay into my brother for Inga Van Susteren's broken window and the massacre of her exotic fish, and the soaking destruction of her carpeted basement. The lecture is about trust and actions and consequences. They do not know I am watching. I am not part of the conversation, but again, I am omniscient in this memory. I can hear my father's thoughts. I can feel his heart in my own. David tells him about the football. He lies to my father straight in the face, lying like I didn't know anybody could lie. He makes it all about the football. Knowing nothing, he is ready to take the bullet. My father pounds the table with the flat of his hand, rattling the plates and the silverware. And it is like a gunshot going off in my head. Suddenly, I am screaming at him, pointing, accusing. My father looks up at me suddenly, his eyes locking on my own. Those eyes know the truth. They see into me as mine see into him. Those eyes know what David cannot possibly explain, even as he takes the blame. Those eyes know my guilt like it is written on my forehead. Is this about getting paid? I asked Milton sharply, indignation surging into my tone. I pivoted from Milton to Simon, who had been replaced by a pallid, lifeless replica fit for a storefront window, his eyes wide and unblinking. Are you really concerned that I'm going to make an entire movie behind your back?
My concern, said Milton calmly, is not about the money. CTR is entitled to its commission, whether we find you the work or someone else finds you the work, even if that someone else is you. Money is the very least of my concern, I assure you.
Then, I said, but Milton interrupted.
CTR sets very high standards for itself, and it has very high standards for its clients. Any two-bit floozy with nice legs and aspirations of stardom can get a talent agent. They're a dime a dozen. CTR is all about long-term relationships with quality artists. And that means trust, Tilly. If I can't trust you, then CTR doesn't want you.
So you're firing me? I asked. You suddenly, out of the fucking blue, don't trust me and you're cutting me loose?
No. Milton patted at the air with his hand. I'm not saying that. No need to get dramatic. All I'm saying is that for this business relationship to work, we need to have an understanding between us about the importance of trust.
I don't think that's an unreasonable request.
Do you?
Of course not, I said. I have been honest.
Then, explain to me why you didn't simply tell me when we met in my office that you had re-auditioned for Blair's little literary movie.
I don't know. I didn't even think of it. I guess I thought that I'd never get the part anyway. Even if I did get the part, I'd never give them the satisfaction of actually going through with it. I mean, what is the big deal?
So, you're saying that if you got the part, you were going to turn them down?
His baritone dripped incredulity. Was a distinct possibility. I was pissed. I'm still pissed. I knocked myself out for that part. I was good. When they pulled the plug, I wanted to move on. I told you that. Others were suing. I didn't want to sue. I wanted to move on. But I couldn't. I wanted to prove that I was the best person for that role. So I did their stupid little paper audition. But that doesn't mean I would have taken it. I guess I didn't see the point of telling you under those circumstances. I was moving on. The audition was for me, not Blair Gaines. Milton looked at me hard for what seemed like a long time. Then he emptied his glass and nodded his head, as if he had resolved something in his own mind.
I had not considered that, Tilly. I hadn't considered that your motivations might be so complicated. I apologize if my little lecture offended you. You're young. You're a pup, and so much of this is new. So much of it is personal, and too little of it is strictly business. It needs to be about business, but it takes time. I need to remind myself of that. It takes time.
He took a dramatically long breath.
I'd like to start again. If that's all right with you. I'd like to keep moving you forward and upward.
We looked at each other.
We have great confidence in your future,
breathed Simon, filling the silence.
Well, Simon, boomed Milton. Are you still here? I thought you left hours ago.
Milton swatted Simon on the shoulder and laughed his best Ed McMahon laugh. Simon smiled meekly, looking a little sick. Milton turned back, now his old, affable self.
So, then, I take it CTR has your permission to tell Mr. Gaines what he can do with his Little Lion screenplay?
I nodded, suddenly feeling a little sick myself.
Good. Simon, get on that first thing this afternoon. Let's nip this in the bud. Then, let's find this kid some work, shall we? I want a good short list of leads by Friday.
Simon nodded repeatedly at these commands like a lab waiting for a tennis ball. Milton looked at his watch.
Well, I'm late. I'm going to ditch out on the bill and let Simon walk you out.
He stood, bowed, kissed my hand.
I'm glad we did this, my dear. I feel like we're a team again. I'll look after you like you were my own daughter.
I nodded and smiled, not knowing my own feelings. He smiled back, confirming our new, extra-honest relationship. He winked at Simon and turned to leave, but then turned sharply back.
I ever tell you about Marlon Brando and Mario Puzo's goat? No? That one's a gut buster. Next time. Next time.
Milton waved and shambled out. Simon flagged the server and paid the bill. By the time we were back on the street blinking in the midday sun, he had found his voice.
Well, that was quite the meeting, wasn't it, Tills? You're not terribly miffed, I hope? Milton speaks his mind. I never saw that coming, I promise.
I should have told him the truth, I said. I wasn't really thinking, I guess.
So, I'll go back to the office and call Gaines and tell him we're passing. Yeah?
I nodded.
Good. Ta then, Tills, we'll be talking. I'm meeting with one of Darnell Lewis's people next week. They're already talking about a Price Point sequel. Fingers crossed.
We waved, and I watched him cross the street, darting traffic to his car. I yelled after him before I could control the impulse. Simon!
Yeah?
I want to read the Lion Tree script anyway. Simon cocked his head, not comprehending. I shrugged. Insomnia! I should have followed him back to his office and taken possession of the script that afternoon. Instead, Simon had shouted that he would pop it in the mail, and stupidly, I had nodded, waved, and let him go. It arrived 2 days later. I opened the envelope immediately but read not a word. For most of that night, the script sat on my kitchen table, beneath a mostly empty carton of lo mein, a sticky pair of chopsticks, 2 cellophane wrappers, and 2 fortune cookies that were strewn across the stack of paper in yellowing shards of broken dough. In my travels to and from the refrigerator, in and out of the kitchen, I glanced furtively at the buried sheaf of paper, reminding myself that since the white rectangle was literally beneath garbage, it must not be very important in the grander scheme of my life. I pretended to watch the news, absorbing none of it. Not the parade of statistics in the run-up to the 2-year anniversary of Hurricane Katrina. Not the $1 trillion price tag for the Iraq War. Not the resignation of the scandal-plagued Attorney General. Not the nightly list of my SAG card-carrying colleagues throwing down for Barack Obama's presidential bid, or the end of actor Fred Thompson's short-lived run for the White House. Not even the $1 billion offer to Governor Schwarzenegger from a coalition of California marijuana growers and dealers to solve the state budget crisis in exchange for pot legalization. None of it was enough to cut through the static in my head.
I turned off the television. Behind me, the kitchen table burned. I could feel the heat on the back of my neck. I knew that by then, Simon's news to Blair was over 2 days old. I also knew that since Blair had not called to try and change my mind, he had given up and relayed the news on to Angus. Blair's people had no doubt already left messages for and arranged meetings with Ivanova No. 2 and her agents. I imagined that since Blair had not gotten his wish with me, he was busy plying Angus with booze and trying every other trick in the book to regain some of the authority he had bargained away. I felt life moving on. I had forced myself to delay, to let the kitchen table burn, to let the time pass. Subconsciously, I had probably hoped that Simon would mail me the script rather than handing it to me, just so that I could take some time off the clock. I had forced myself to let that part of the world roll on without me. Milton Chenoweth had been playing the game long enough to recognize a bad idea when he saw one. He was right. And I knew he was right. I knew that when Blair's production collapsed all over again and Ivanova No. 2 inevitably filed her lawsuit, I would be glad that I had let it go. I would be glad I had been thrown clear of Blair. Glad that fate or dumb luck had extricated me from his needs and from my guilt for increasingly loathing the sight of him. I would be glad I had sidestepped the mutually demeaning indignity of Angus Mann and myself trading pleasantries on the set, as if I had no idea how much he increasingly loathed the sight of me. I would be glad I had avoided having to take cinematic direction simultaneously from two men, one who loved or needed me too much to restrain his emotions, and one who disliked me too much to be honest, neither of whom were sufficiently detached to provide direction. I finally gave in a little before 11, tired of pretending that I did not care, but sufficiently convinced that it was too late, no matter what I thought of the script, to go backward. Forward and upward, as Milton had said. Forward and upward. I read the first page standing at the kitchen table, with the only light behind me in the hallway, as though casually leafing through the last of a newspaper before throwing it away. By the second page, I was sitting. By the third page, I was floating across the threshold of a world that felt like an old dream that had somehow been enhanced and restored. I was thirsty and uncomfortable. The light was too dim, and I could feel the headache coming. But I didn't move. I couldn't. I was transfixed. All the elements were there on the page, typewritten, not processed as though words were a kind of chickpea that could be blended and spread like an indiscriminate mash on a piece of bread. I recognized the half-moon periods that ended every sentence, the bashful H's and the broken J's. He had reincorporated everything that made the original short story such a marvel. All the original plot. All the characters. All the pathos. And yet the sameness was somehow different. It was like the opposite of seeing a ghost, a mere apparition of someone you once knew. Instead, the lion tree of my memory was the ghost. And suddenly, before me, I found that it had taken real and substantive form. The entire story had been scrubbed clean of Hollywood's fingerprints. Gone was the tinfoil pandering ornamentation soldered on by Blair's erstwhile screenwriting team, the spate of wittily teasing repartee, the camera's unquestioned bias for physicality in the depiction of love and longing, the gratuitous subtext of menace and danger, as though Lieutenant Miller just might be psychopathic, the montage of tedium and hair maintenance, as Angus had once called it, to show the ungodly time it takes to cover any expanse of interstellar space. All that was gone. Gone, too, were all Blair's well-meaning but clumsy fixes, narrative bridges, flashbacks, voiceovers, and workarounds. It was all Angus now, from the first to the last. From the fecundity of old Africa to the sterility of Ruton Baker. From one abandonment to the next, one love to the next, one regret to the next. It was all Angus. To be sure, the screenplay was a translation, but it was a beautiful translation into something new. A new medium, yes, but something else as well. Something as good or better than the story itself. Angus had restored the Lion Tree to a seamless and simple piece of storytelling, with clean, thematic arcs and Spartanic streamlined dialogue. So many words were gone. Eradicated. He had massacred them, mowing them down by the hundreds and thousands. Angus was a writer for whom words were precious and therefore few. For his characters, words were merely weightless spores blown about by emotion, as far apart from each other as planets. The drama lay not in the words themselves, but in the journey across empty space, from one word to the next. Cinematically, words were merely pivot points for the far more supple and elegant language of the human face. Thematically, the words were a handful of small, smooth stones that Angus had skipped across the surface of nothingness, showing purely by contrast what ripples and splashes in the empty spaces of the interstellar heart feel like, and the unbearable toll the sound of those disturbances can make. It was impossible for me not to see the finished product in my head as my eyes passed over the scaffolding of Angus's words. The story I had read so many times, beginning so long ago, unspooled in the dim space above my kitchen table, in a kind of slow motion, cinematic poetry of light and image and sound. Like something large and slow and aquatic, swimming effortlessly in moonlight. It positively gleamed. Most rewarding of all was to hear Ivanova's voice in my head. It felt like it had been a very long time. I had grown used to hearing the voice of Sienna Price every morning, month in and month out, her plucky perfection and razor wit, her fetish for the double entendre, and a wink in every other syllable, pushing Ivanova deeper and deeper back into the cottony darkness of my memory. But upon reading her first few words, Ivanova came back powerfully, and somewhere in that cottony darkness, the lights flickered on. I wanted her. The thought came to me in scene after scene, like a heartbeat pushing out through my fingertips. She was mine,
She was me. The very thought of someone else, anyone else, speaking her words made my stomach collapse into itself. Then I remembered that Elena Ivanova was no longer mine to have. Simon Hunter, at the bidding of Milton Chenoweth, and with my own cowardly consent, had given her away. My heart sank, aching as it fell. I considered whether I could simply call Simon in the morning and tell him I had changed my mind. I could tell him to tell Blair that we had gotten our wires crossed. What would be the harm? Simon would hesitate. He would call Milton. Milton would stall, and then he would call me to talk me out of it. I told myself that over the past 3 days. Angus and Blair had moved on. Ivanova number 2 was already working her way through a second highlighter, and the agents were firming things up. Hands had been shaken. All of which may well have been true. Although, in my heart of hearts, I knew that the real reason I could not call Milton had less to do with it being too late to try than it did with my fear that it was not too late at all. And that Milton, he of the silver tongue and impeccable business logic, would actually succeed in talking me out of the Lion Tree all over again. I imagined the conversation. Milton would dangle a unique opportunity, one that no sane actor in my position would pass up, but one that presented an obligation that absolutely conflicted with Blair's new production schedule. Milton would present me with a choice at the proverbial fork. One road led forward and upward, and the other road, the road to the Lion Tree, ended in cinematic oblivion. That road, he would say, led backward and downward. It meant more headache and less money for everyone. He would smile kindly and place his tremulous hand on mine and give me the line again about spotting the sharks and the charlatans and about looking out for me as if I was his own daughter. He would make it a test of my true character, reading me at eye level for signs of self-deception and naive, wrong-headed thinking. He would praise me for coming to him first this time, so that he might give me the benefit of his honest advice, but only to make it abundantly clear that if I rejected that advice, I was a fool. A fool in whose actions and character he would be very, very disappointed. I stood up and grabbed the phone from the kitchen wall, dialing from memory. Blair.
What? Who? Tilly John?
He was slow, disoriented.
Yeah. It's Christ. It's 3 in the morning. What's wrong?
I want the part.
You want? I talked to Simon Hunter, just...
Fuck Simon Hunter. And Milton, too. I want Ivanova. A woman's voice is in the background, distant and groggy.
Tilly, we're already talking with another girl. I thought you were passing.
That's not her next to you, is it?
Who? No, fuck. What's it to you anyway?
Because it would be a whole lot faster if you could just roll over and tell her that she doesn't have the part.
You know the shitstorm this will cause? I mean, we're already...
Fix it, Blair. You wanted me, you've got me. You've fixed everything else, so fix whatever is left.
Angus is stuck with me, but you tell him he won't be sorry. There was a long pause. I listened to him thinking.
You read it then?
He finally whispered.
Yes. Just now.
Fucking brilliant, yeah?
Brilliant.
I hung up the phone and sat back down at the kitchen table. I flipped back through the script, spot reading here and there. I thought of Angus, the man who had written the words that lay in my hands, and who thought me unworthy to speak them.
Ivanova has a certain moral rectitude about her,
Blair had said, more than implying that I did not have a certain moral rectitude. I knew the pressure would be on to do Ivanova justice, on and off the set. I also knew that Blair would not abandon his ulterior motives, and that he would feel more emboldened than he had in a very long time. He had something I needed, and that I wanted to keep. That would be his leverage. And yet, any step by me in that direction, aside from prostituting myself, would risk so offending Angus Mann that he would almost certainly insist on recasting Ivanova again and forever. As if Blair's designs were not enough of a challenge, I knew that the media obsession with the love triangle that was me and Zach West and Maria Beckwith would endure as long as Price Point was in production, and would likely resurface once the promotion junkets began. The overlap of the two movies would, by itself, cause Angus enough heartburn to second-guess his willingness to give me the job, assuming Blair was even able to talk him back into it. But as difficult as I knew all those complications would ultimately prove to be, I was determined to do Ivanova justice. The more disturbed I imagined Angus over the prospect of my involvement, the more determined I became. I knew his fidelity to Ivanova, that when he dreamed of her. I knew because I felt the same, and I was willing to hold the stench of myself under his nose to prove it to him. Of course, at that point, pacing away the early morning, unable to sleep in the excitement, wanting a cigarette but mightily resisting the urge, considering my future in a way I had not in many months. I had not anticipated the sex scandal. And while there was no way I could have known about the video, that fact would prove to be excruciatingly irrelevant. But then, generally speaking, sex scandals, as much in Hollywood as in Columbus, do have a way of making every other light in the universe dim.